She had the most compelling eyes, and there was a deep sadness in her. I could see that sadness.
From Wyoming Public Media, this is Human Nature, real stories where humans and our habitat meet. I'm Caroline Ballard. Today, we'll hear two stories about journeys to freedom, on two legs and four.
You are spunky.
Hi. Who is this?
Hi, Jules.
Hi. Very nice to make your acquaintance.
She is such a great dog.
So
Julie, you just love the peoples. You just love peoples. Sparky.
This is my tiny terror, Sparks.
And that's Susan Wydell. Her house is on the Wyoming prairie, with lots of space for her dogs to run and play. Our visit to Susan's home was specifically to meet one of her dogs, Little Red.
Little. Let me get a cookie.
She loves treats, and so she's highly treat motivated.
You and me both, little food motivated.
Yeah, you come right on, food baby girl. Oh, and you're not the only one, so I'll have you give her a treat.
Okay. Come on, Noodles.
Over here, Julie. I'll keep you busy.
Littles, over here, honey. Come on. Littles.
You know, I should probably put these other guys out. It's just going to be...
the party.
Mm-hmm. Julie, come on. Julie, Chito, just for a little bit, babies. Come on, you go out. Come on, Chito. Chito, Chito. Come on, buddy.
Little Red is a pit bull. As her name suggests, she's got a reddish coat with some gray. She's 14 years old. It's a bit chilly, so Little's wearing a pink dog sweater. And she's shy, but treats help.
Come on, Legos.
Hi.
Come on, baby girl, sit. Sit. Can you shake? Can you give high five to Carolyn? You sit. High five.
Oh, wow.
Yes, give your high five.
You still give got it.
Yeah, sit, there baby. High five.
High five.
There you go. Good girl.
I got
girl.
Another one for you right here.
Yeah.
There you go.
Good girl, Little. Good girl. You love your treats. Yes, she's a treat lady. She has treats
that
for
is,
you.
Yeah.
Hi.
Good girl. Nice to meet you.
Good girl.
You came a long way to be here.
She did. She crisscrossed the country. She went from Virginia to southern Utah and then here.
For the first 5 years or so of her life, Little Red was chained to a car axle in a clearing in the Virginia woods. She was part of NFL quarterback Michael Vick's dogfighting ring, Bad News Kennels.
And they had them stationed so that the dogs could not see each other. They didn't want them to have sight. They had sound. And so it would help increase the aggression and anxiety about other dogs. So it was all, you know, engineered to keep the dogs kind of amped up when they were around each other so that they would fight better.
She's pretty small. She was smaller than I
yeah, she only weighs about 38 pounds. The game dogs used for fighting are small. You know, Jules would never make a fight dog, my big pit bull, never. She's too big, and she lumbers. The little dogs, the smaller ones, are much more agile. And so that's they breed them to be small in the fight world.
Yeah, she's littles.
Graying a little around the muzzle.
She is. She's very, you know, she's, her face, well... This is a picture of her when I first saw her.
Oh, wow.
And look how red she was. Mm. And I've kept that picture. I saw her and I read about her. I think it was in the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times. And she just touched my heart.
What was it about Little Red that drew you to her?
You know, I think it was something about the look in her eyes. She had the most compelling eyes. And there was a deep sadness in her. I could see that sadness. She had been brutalized, and she did not trust people. But you could see in her eyes that she had great gentleness, and that's what I saw when I looked at her.
Do you ever still see any sadness in her?
I see sadness in her all the time. I do. I'd never had a pit bull. I was sort of afraid of them. I've had dogs for years, but never a pit, and I never thought twice about it. I wanted to adopt her. And it took almost four years.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, it looks like she's got a little bit of scarring up there, too.
Yeah, she does. She actually has scars all over her body. Her face has very little fur on it. You see that she has no fur on her muzzle. It's just all taken off by the fighting. Mm-hmm. She also had her teeth either yanked out or filed down. So her teeth are filed way down. And she's missing quite a few. And so, you know, she was a bait dog, most likely. They used her for the fighting dogs to practice on.
Little Red's journey to a home began 10 years ago, when she and dozens of other dogs were rescued from Bad News Kennels. Eventually, the most traumatized dogs from the fighting ring were sent to Best Friends Animal Sanctuary in Utah. They were called the most vicious dogs in America. And from the beginning, most people thought they were doomed.
Historically, dogs like these who were rescued from fighting situations were basically considered unsavable, and they were simply euthanized.
Filmmaker Darcy Dennett had a front row seat to the unfolding drama. She was at Best Friends filming for the National Geographic show Dogtown when the Michael Vick dogs arrived. The experience was so compelling, she stayed on to film her own documentary about the dogs, called The Champions.
When people told me that we would be filming with Michael Vick's fighting dogs, I guess I didn't know what to imagine they would be like, but what they ended up being like was so completely different from what I had envisioned that I really just couldn't even believe it. 22 of these dogs were considered so damaged and beyond repair that they simply weren't worth fighting for. Dogs that both the Humane Society and PETA thought should be euthanized. But Best Friends and other organizations stood up for these dogs and believed that they could change. And they didn't even believe that they could change. They believed that these dogs were worth saving. Millions of dogs in America are euthanized every year, adoptable dogs in shelters across the country. So why spend time and money and resources on 22 that were so considered so challenging? And I think that the reason is that every life is worth fighting for, that every life has value. And I think that the thing that struck me probably most when the dogs first arrived was that they really just seemed scared. They barked quite a lot. These dogs probably had very little interaction with people that was positive. They probably had very little routine in their lives. They probably weren't fed with any kind of regularity or ever given a toy or played with. A lot of the dogs really weren't comfortable walking on a leash. It might speak to the fact that they were never taken for a walk, or possibly when they were put on a leash, it was when they were being taken to the dog fighting ring at the compound. Really, it just seemed like they had very little experience with people. And what was very interesting to me was that it became pretty quickly apparent that many of the dogs were much more comfortable with other dogs than they were with people. So despite the fact that these were supposed to be vicious, aggressive, fighting dogs who didn't like other dogs, they actually really gravitated towards other dogs because I think that they trusted them more than they trusted people. There are so few dogs who are willing to fight. It really just isn't in their nature. You know, most of these dogs were put into a position where they either had to fight for their life or die.
But there were at least two dogs in the group who were thought to be former fighting champions.
Those dogs tend to have more aggression issues with other dogs, but they also tend to be incredibly good with people. These dogs' tendency is to want to please the people that they're with.
One of those fighting champions was a pit bull named Lucas.
Lucas had scars all over his face. He was clearly a dog who had fought. And one of the things that surprised me most about Lucas was that despite the fact that he had so many scars all over his face, he was this big, sort of scary looking dog, except for that he was so friendly. I mean, I think the thing that really struck me about Lucas was that he was just not at all what I had imagined he would be. Here was this dog who had been so terribly abused by humans, who in fact, the most striking thing about him was that he was just so incredibly friendly with people. I remember going into his run, and he literally like leapt into my arms and like covered me with kisses, and it's this huge dog covered with scars. And just sort of realizing in that moment that, you know, these dogs, their biggest problem was going to be overcoming this stigma of being pit bulls, one, but dogs rescued from a fighting situation, two, but pit bulls rescued from Michael Vick's dogfighting ring, three. But that in fact, they were creatures that had suffered terrible abuse, but were capable of loving and trusting humans.
Unlike Lucas, another dog named Cherry was terrified of people.
When Cherry first arrived, he was so completely traumatized and shut down. He would do something called pancaking, where he would flatten on all fours and refuse to walk. He was entirely shut down emotionally. He just was so terrified of people that he would almost try to disappear, try to make himself invisible. It was very hard to get close to him because he would just sort of cower in a corner. Michelle Besman, who was featured in the film, spent months with Cherry just simply getting him okay with being in the same space with her. So she would sit in a room with Cherry for hours, just in the same space, not trying to touch him, just getting him used to her presence there. And then slowly, very slowly over the course of time, Cherry finally, and we happened to be there and captured it on film, Cherry slowly yawned and decided that it was time to come over and sit next to Michelle. And that was a huge step for Cherry to take. And that took, I don't even know how long it took. It must have taken, you know, months. I think it was months. And that was one little step. And then Michelle proceeded to spend many, many more months. She would bring Cherry to her office and let him simply sit under the desk with her in a very sort of low pressure, non-threatening way, just slowly getting Cherry used to the idea that being in the company of people could be a positive thing and a good thing. And I think Cherry slowly came to associate Michelle with treats or affection, stability, and love. And Cherry was one of the first dogs who Best Friends decided was ready to be adopted. And so after spending a few years working with Cherry, Michelle had to, this is the part of the film that always kind of makes me cry, because she had to put him in a car and send him away to his forever home. Cherry's sort of confused and doesn't know why she's saying goodbye. And so this dog, who is pretty much considered unsavable, was given a second chance to go to an adoptive home in Connecticut.
But that wasn't the last time Darcy saw Cherry.
I live here in New York City, and every year, Best Friends Animal Society has a fundraising event called Strut Your Mutt. There are hundreds of people who come to walk their dogs along the Hudson River. And I walk my dog, Nina, at this event. And I remember seeing, about 4 or 5 years ago, there was a black pit bull who was surrounded by a group of people. And the dog looked very happy. He's wagging his tail. He was getting all this attention from the semicircle of people gathered around him. And I look up and I realize that it's the couple who had adopted Cherry. And here, years later, I'm at this really busy event where this dog has miraculously transformed into this loving, trusting creature who had learned how to trust humans again after all the abuse he had suffered. And I couldn't believe that with time, patience, and love, and when given a second chance, that this dog had been able to change to the extent that he had. In the beginning of the time that I spent working with Cherry, I assumed that he would never get that far, that it just was never gonna happen, that he would maybe spend the rest of his life at the sanctuary, which was an amazing place, that he would never really be able to have very close bonds with people because he was simply too traumatized by his experience with them. I just assumed that he wouldn't get very far. But the dogs proved me so wrong, you know? And the people who believe in these dogs proved me so wrong. And I think that for me is the real story here.
Cherry has gone on to live something of a red carpet life. He's attended more than 10 screenings of Darcy's film, The Champions. On the other hand, Cherry's buddy back at the sanctuary, a pit called Handsome Dan, still struggles with the trauma he suffered.
I really loved Handsome Dan because he was so beautiful. He is so beautiful. When the trainers at Best Friends introduced Handsome Dan to Cherry, both of them were very fearful of people, but when they introduced them to each other, they immediately sort of blossomed. Handsome Dan is very fearful of people, even to this day, as a result of his experience at Bad News Kennels. He really can't take walks out of the neighborhood because he's simply too fearful to be out in a space where anything could happen. He's able to go on walks in this one place on this peninsula that's very quiet and that has water on both sides, so he feels sort of surrounded and safe. But Heather, the woman who adopted him, has come up with this Popemobile. It's like a stroller that you would maybe use for a baby, but it's big enough to put a pit bull in, and Handsome Dan actually feels comfortable enough in his Popemobile to be taken out for walks. So Handsome Dan is, you know, very, very shy, and so he lives sort of a very quiet, protected life with his family in Rhode Island.
When Little Red moved to Wyoming, it was a hard adjustment for her, too.
She likes her bed.
She does.
She likes her home.
She does. She likes her home very much, and you know, it was difficult for her at first because she had never lived in a home. She was afraid of crossing thresholds. She was afraid of just coming up even 2 steps. She was afraid of the dishwasher, afraid of the washing machine. You know, just things she had never experienced. Any sudden noises really, really frightened her.
Little Red's trainer made the trip to Wyoming with her and stayed at Susan's house for 4 days, helping Little Red adjust.
And when her trainer left, she was absolutely bereft. She just was the most forlorn dog. She would go to the far corner in the front pasture and just lay down. And that was the last place she had seen the trainer as her trainer drove away. You know, I always thought if a dog could cry, she would be sobbing. And she just laid there. And so Chito went out and got her. He laid down beside her. And finally, after maybe an hour, she was able to get up, and I carried her back to the house, and he came with her. And, you know, I knew that for her, she realized that the life that she had grown to love at the sanctuary, she had been there for 3.5 years, that life was over. And so it was a real process for her to adjust. It took, I'd say, at least 6 months. And there were many times when I thought, I've made a terrible mistake. She was better off where she was. She was happy there. She had staff people who adored her. They would hold her and rock her in a rocking chair. But over time, she really made the transition, and it was the dogs that helped her, not me.
A lot of people have a lot of misconceptions about pit bulls, that their jaws lock like a vise, that they're tenacious and they never let go, that they are dangerous with cats and other dogs. And the most amazing one to me is that, you know, this idea that pit bulls don't feel pain. And I think that's a very convenient thing for people to feel about animals in general, that, you know, they don't feel pain in the way that we do. That, you know, a dog wouldn't feel cold if you left it out in the winter while you're wearing a sweater, that because it's a dog, it doesn't feel cold. I just think it's fascinating how humans are really good at creating this idea of like the other, and that because something isn't human, that they don't feel in the same way that we do. But really, pit bulls are just dogs.
What effect has the film had on the public perception of pit bulls?
I think that a picture is worth 1,000 words, and I think that a film maybe is worth even more. When you see a visual of a dog like Cherry on a couch with his cat named Walker, licking the cat, he's sitting next to him happily purring, I think that just speaks volumes. I think people have very strong associations with the word pit bull, and I think what's amazing to see is that through films like The Champions and through the work of people like Best Friends and others, that people aren't associating pit bulls with negative things anymore. I think people are associating pit bulls with the family dog that they once were historically.
They are loving dogs, and they're very, very good family dogs. She is a great example. All of the horrible things that were done to her, and she is still a sweet and gentle dog. They are people pleasers. They love to please their people. She is just as sweet as can be. And Jules, my other pit bull, is trained as a therapy dog. She loves people, and she loves attention. You know, she thrives on it, and she's so sweet.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking over at Little and Jules right now, and I mean, Little's in her bed, and Jules is getting some major love from our producer, Aaron, and definitely not what I would call vicious dogs by any stretch of the imagination.
And, you know, all of the dogs that were rescued from Vic are sweet dogs.
Like people, dogs are individuals. They experience things differently, and their life experience shapes who they are. I think that people really underestimate how intelligent and emotional animals are. Just because they can't talk doesn't mean that they're any less valuable than we are as humans. I think that the depth that animals have is really pretty amazing.
Our storytellers were Darcy Dennett and Susan Wydell. Little Red died peacefully on April 2nd, almost 10 years to the day since she was rescued from Bad News Kennels back in 2007. She was in Susan's arms until the end. We feel so fortunate to have met her. You're listening to Human Nature. I'm Caroline Ballard. In this next story, we'll hear about two young women who escaped slavery in the 1800s and walked a long way to freedom. We'll also hear about the man who learned their story 150 years later and brought it to life in his own journey. Barry Jurgensen first read about Celia and Eliza when he was in grad school.
They were enslaved by a man named Stephen Knuckles. They had been with the Knuckles family ever since they were born. And we do know that eventually, from Virginia, Eliza and Celia accompanied the Knuckles family to the territory of Nebraska. It is believed by a few historians that the two girls were possibly used for sex by Stephen Knuckles. It did happen during those antebellum years, where slaveholders abused their slaves sexually. While in Nebraska City, where they ended up settling, the two girls met a man named John Williamson. And John Williamson was part Black, part Indian, either Choctaw or Cherokee. And he told them that he was there to help. And if they wanted his help, he would help them gain their freedom. And so they took him up on it. And on Thanksgiving night in 1858, they, with the help of John Williamson, crossed the Missouri River on their way to freedom. Celia was 14 and Eliza was 16 years old. And they made a journey, the two girls from Nebraska City. They traveled all across Iowa with the help of people on the Underground Railroad and made their way to Chicago.
Seems like a pretty big decision for a couple of teenagers.
Yeah. I mean, the most important element of the Underground Railroad is the men and women who were enslaved that made that courageous choice to break away from what they knew and to know that they should be treated differently and they should be free.
Celia and Eliza's bravery stuck with Barry through a job with the Park Service, and even when he became a middle school and high school history teacher.
I have an honors history class that I teach. It's a dual credit course. They receive college credit. And we do this huge research project where we help the National Park Service identify, preserve, and nominate historic sites associated with the Underground Railroad. It was during all of these conferences that I was presenting at, there was an exhibit on modern day slavery. And then I saw that the average age of a young girl or boy forced into modern day slavery, which many call human trafficking today, is 13 years old. And in the United States, the main form of slavery that we see today is sexual slavery. And I automatically thought of Eliza and Celia when I saw this exhibit.
Barry had an idea to somehow symbolically connect Celia and Eliza's story with modern-day slavery. He wanted to bring awareness to human trafficking and raise money for an organization that fights it, and also bring history alive for his students. He decided it was time to do something he'd been toying with since he'd learned about Celia and Eliza. Follow in their footsteps, all 500 miles from Nebraska City to Chicago. Up until now, he'd hesitated to go on this walk.
I was just really nervous about getting hit by a car. If something bad would have happened to me, it would have been so hard to lose my children and my wife. They're my world. But in the end, I just told myself that all the people that I've researched and I've studied on the Underground Railroad, they all made tremendous sacrifices themselves. And anybody that was any type of activist sacrifice something. I wanted to be like them. It felt wrong not to do it. And with the permission of my wife, we talked about why I was doing it. She completely understood and was supportive of it.
So Barry pitched the idea to his students.
We had a school assembly right around Frederick Douglass's birthday. And, you know, I told the assembly what my thoughts were about human trafficking and its connection to historic slavery, but also that if good people never do anything about an injustice, then that injustice will just keep growing and will keep affecting other people. It's our duty as citizens to do something.
So a few students volunteered to walk with Barry, some for just a few hours, and some for almost the whole trip. Three committed to sticking with Barry through most of the walk.
The youngest girl was Tiara Krivolovic, and she is a junior in high school now. Her sister, Tamisha Krivolovic, had just graduated high school, and then Austin Harms had just graduated high school. And I had been teaching these three students ever since they're in seventh grade. Those three are just an amazing example of what students are capable of doing.
Why did those three students join on?
I believe that Tamisha and Tiara, who are both African-American, they really related to it. And they always really liked, even in my eighth grade class where I taught them about Underground Railroad, I think they're extremely enthused and interested in the topic. So I think that kind of compelled them to do the walk. But also I think they wanted to do something and they wanted to do as much as they could. Austin, he has actually enlisted with the Marines, and he partially wanted to do it to kind of help him prepare for boot camp. But in the end, he realized that, you know, as a Marine, you're fighting for our freedoms. I think he realized that there are so many people in this country that fall victim to slavery, and they lose those freedoms. And it was like it was helping him prepare for that fight.
Barry and the students got organized with help from the school community. For months, they advertised and planned. Finally, the June 2016 day came to start the long walk. The walkers and their supporters gathered in Nebraska City, where Celia and Eliza had been enslaved, just across the Missouri River from Iowa.
My mother was there, and three of my seventh grade students, who were all girls, they showed up as well to walk just a quarter of the day. And a few other friends were setting out, and it was all fun. We're all joking, and we're walking down the streets of Nebraska City, talking about the story of Celia and Eliza. And then we get to the Missouri River. We're getting on a very busy highway. Cars just zooming past, and we're supposed to get across this bridge. And just on the other side, you see trees, you see kind of a marshy area in nature out across the Missouri River and farm ground. And it was like, okay, we gotta get through this first obstacle here. We gotta not get hit by a vehicle. And there were a few people that actually followed us with their hazard lights on to slow the people down behind us. We were going with traffic across the bridge. And about halfway across this fairly long bridge across the Missouri River, a semi truck about took us out, took all of us out. Right then and there, I was like, oh my gosh, I'm putting other people's lives in danger because of this idea I had. And it made me kind of question what I was doing at that point. But we kept going, and we got across. And, you know, as soon as we got across, it was actually really amazing because we could see all sorts of wildlife on the banks of the Missouri River on the Iowa side. And we were by ourselves. We weren't in a town anymore. We were in the country. And it was like, it was just one of the coolest feelings. The Missouri River, which is also known as the Big Muddy, is I'm not quite sure how wide it was. I bet about a quarter of a mile wide. Standing on the bank of that river and thinking about crossing it, that was formidable. That was kind of eye-opening because that river, it moves pretty fast at times, and that river is, to me, it's a big part of Celia and Eliza's escape.
I ain't fit to be no mother. I ain't fit to
cross that river, something that looks so difficult, so scary, so intimidating. And they cross that river into a land of hope for their future. Celia and Eliza had to have been scared at the get-go, because right as soon as they crossed the Missouri the day after, Stephen Knuckles was right behind him with a posse. He ended up beating up several people in a place called Civil Bend, Iowa, and nearly lynching two free black men. And he followed them for a few days. And so they had to have heard that he was right behind him. And I can't imagine what that would have felt like. But also, you know, these two young girls had never been to Iowa or Illinois before. And if they were by themselves, they could have walked up to a person that had pro-slavery sentiments, and that would have returned them for the reward that Knuckles was asking. So they had no idea who to trust and who to fear. I'm sure Celia and Eliza questioned their faith in humanity, and studying so much history on my part, at the beginning of this walk, I definitely questioned humanity and kind of lost faith in humanity doing the right thing. But on both of our walks, we actually saw the best in humanity. That day was one of the longest walks. It was about 26 miles. We were all carrying packs with camelbacks in them and extra water and, you know, an extra pair of shoes, because this was our first day and we wanted to see which pair of shoes was going to be best. We got to visit a cemetery, actually, in Civil Bend, the town that was implicated with the Celia and Eliza escape, and we visited the graves of many people that helped them. And the town no longer exists, but we were in the place. We were there where all of that happened, where Celia and Eliza went through. And that was pretty amazing, to be there and to be in the presence of some of the people that were buried there that helped Celia and Eliza escape. We then, after about 17 miles of walking, everybody had blisters, everybody was really sore, and we were like, oh my gosh, we have like 10 more miles left, how are we going to do this? And all of a sudden a horse-drawn wagon pulls up and said, hey, I heard you guys are walking through here, and you wanted to assimilate, you know, what the two girls went through. And they actually got a ride on a horse and carriage part of the way from Civil Bend to Tabor, Iowa, which was our destination. And we jumped in there and we thought that was going to be amazing. It was amazing. And the driver was amazing. His name was Richard. And I got to know him. But as soon as that ride was over, we got into Tabor. I was the sorest I had ever been, because I realized that wagon does not have shocks. And I could barely walk that night. I had a hard time. I had a hard time just laying down. I had to have someone hold my hands while I kind of fell back onto. We slept at a bed and breakfast that night. Somebody put us up at a bed and breakfast, and holy moly, it was another kind of pain. I actually presented to the people of Tabor. A few people came to hear me talk, and actually I spoke and presented at a majority of the towns that we stayed at. That really got me more connected with the abolitionists that would have walked from town to town, and they would have gave speeches, presentations in schoolhouses, churches, you know, city halls, all different sorts of places, trying to convince people that slavery was evil and that it should be abolished. And I really kind of made that connection that, man, those men and women were tough. This was going to be a long, arduous journey.
The group continued. Barry says sometimes people they met along the way hosted them at their houses, and sometimes they camped.
Every morning when we woke up, we thought, what was going to be the cool thing that we're going to see today? Who are we going to meet? What's the next town going to be like that we're going to stay? You know, is someone going to offer their home to us, allow us to stay with them, help do our laundry? You know, you think, man, if somebody talks to me, am I going to smell really bad? I just remember the smell of sunscreen and beef jerky, actually. I had a lot of beef jerky along the way. I had sunscreen on my fingers a lot when I ate, and so that always kind of mixed in with my food. Facebook page called Walk Forever Free, there were some negative comments. Especially there's just one that kind of sticks out to me. I took a video. I just used my smartphone the whole way. I was taking a video like you would a selfie, and one of the girls was walking behind me, and then Austin was behind her, and I captured all of us walking together, and all of a sudden I got tons of criticism for that video, because it appeared like I was simulating her master and she was asleep because she was walking behind me, and it looked like she was being contained by two white guys, and that was totally not what it was supposed to come out like. It was supposed to be like, hey, we're walking the journey of Celia and Eliza, and we're bringing awareness about modern day slavery, but people still took offense to it. It really, the whole experience opened my eyes, and I'm glad that Tierra and Tamisha were with me. They were just awesome. I mean, they woke up with smiles every single morning. They were always upbeat and ready to rock and roll. The only thing I regret is that those two girls were somewhat berated with negative comments about the walk. But that did open my eyes to the reality of the state of our country. I had a talk with the girls about that and Austin, because I think they were pretty fired up and angry. You know, I try to tell them it's when someone puts out that much hatred towards you, the wrong thing is to return that hatred with hatred. You have to have compassion for that person and understand where that person came from. I mean, what their history was. Something must have happened to them to formulate their opinion. Compassion is what we as a society need to go back to heal all this division. And we were talking about that already on our walk. And so they wanted to reply and have a whole, I don't know, back and forth kind of argument. And I said, no, we can't do that. This whole thing is about compassion. And that's the only way the two girls made it. And that's the only way we're going to make it. And it's the only way that our country's going to make it is through compassion and truly understanding one another.
Toward the end of the trip, all of Barry's students had to go home, so he kept going by himself. He was walking down the road on his way to Ashton, Illinois.
I was supposed to go to a park where I was going to camp out, or a friend of mine was going to pick me up and I was going to stay at his house. I get to the town, I start walking to the park, and I tell myself, oh boy, this is Sunday. I really hope there isn't a family there trying to have a picnic. And then they see this bearded guy with a pack and big hat on. And they're going to think right away, like, oh my gosh, like a hobo. Or not that hobos are bad, but they get scared or make judgments. And I was just really fearing that. And then I get into the park, and here there's a huge family having a big picnic in the shelter. And I'm like, oh no. I don't want to mess up their day. And so I just started walking over to an open area where I was going to sit down and eat my lunch. And all of a sudden I hear a guy yell over, hey, you want something to eat? And I'm like, oh, wait, are they talking to me? And I go, what was that? And he repeated it. And I said, if you're willing, yeah, I'll come over and have a bite. I might smell a little. And so I went over and, I mean, people got me plate and they just started throwing food on my plate. It was amazing. I mean, I ate so well that day. It was just ridiculous. And I sat down and I talked with that family and I got a big group picture with them. They were just amazing. And once they found out my story, they were so excited. The next day, I was leaving that town, and about a half mile into the walk, I'm in the highway outside of town, and I see this truck drive by me, and he pulls into this little driveway that goes into an empty cornfield, And I'm like, oh no, he's getting out. What's going to happen here? And it turns out it was the man that offered me food the previous day. His name was Tom. And he comes out and he shakes my hand. And he goes, hey, I was hoping to catch you before you left town. He goes, and it's ironic that I caught you here, because he pointed over at the cornfield that he parked next to. And he said, this was my mom's farm. And over there is where I grew up. And today's my mom's birthday. But she also had passed away a year ago that day. And he told me about how his mom had cancer, and she suffered, you know, she struggled with that for a pretty long time, and he was with her. He was with her the whole time, right next to her. And when it was getting towards the end, they knew she was going to die. She wanted to give Tom some money. She wanted to give him something. You know, the last couple of days she was alive, she slipped a $100 bill into his hand. And Tom said, no, 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 Mom, I don't want this. And his mom says, I know, but you'll know you can use this, and you'll know when. And he had kept that $100 bill in his wallet that ever since. And he broke down, and I broke down, and I couldn't believe that was happening. And then all of a sudden he opened his wallet and he pulled out the $100 bill, and he said, this is the $100 bill. And he had it all folded up, and he had it in a little space in his wallet, because he had never parted from it. He always kept it in his wallet, waiting for that time when he would need it, like his mom said. And he goes, I finally realized where this $100 bill is going to go. It's going to go to you. It just didn't seem real. The whole story, it was crazy. It was almost fate that I walked through that town to that park, and I met Tom and his family. And it was by far one of the more overwhelming events that I experienced on the walk. Once in Chicago, we don't really know what happened to Celia, but we do know that Eliza, who would have been about 18 years old in 1860, was working at a brothel in Chicago. And unfortunately, Stephen Knuckles was still looking for the two girls after they had escaped 2 years earlier, and had found out that Eliza was working in the brothel. And so he traveled all the way to Chicago to capture her and return her to slavery under the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850. And he found someone to help him in Chicago. They had her arrested, and she was locked up in an armory in downtown Chicago. And the amazing part about this part of the story is that the people of Chicago, the free black population, and several white people worked together to help her escape again. And she disappears. We don't really know what happened to her. Most assume that she went to Canada from Chicago.
On July 3rd, 2016, after a journey of over 500 miles, Barry walked into Chicago.
I was accompanied by two men, Robert Benz and Kenneth Morris Jr., who are co-creators of the foundation we were raising money for, the Frederick Douglass Family Initiative. And they had been walking with me for the previous 2 days, and we were in Chicago, West Chicago. Our route was taking us through a pretty rough neighborhood, we were told. I had never been to Chicago. And we were warned that a lot of the shootings that had been taking place that summer, this past June, were happening in that route that we were taking through Chicago. And I'm not going to lie, I was getting kind of nervous. Kenneth, who is African-American, Robert was white, and they have been working to fight human trafficking for a long time. They've been in a lot of bad neighborhoods. And they said something that was really eye-opening to me. And they said, Barry, we're not going to go around. We're going to go through it. We're going to go through it. Because if you submit to what the media says about neighborhoods, they are talking about a few people that are committing these crimes. But they're not talking about all the other people that live there that just want to live their lives and are good people. They said, never give in to that. So I was like, okay, I'm doing this. It completely energized me. And we walked through that neighborhood. It was in the morning. We had people saying, God bless you and good morning. And we talked to several people. It was a great time. It was a great time. We started to get closer and closer to downtown Chicago. I saw the skyscrapers for the first time. I was excited, but I was also a little depressed. I was like, kind of want to keep going. I want to keep talking to people and keep working at this. And I felt like I hadn't done enough yet. I was pretty down on myself, and you know, I should have been excited, but I couldn't help it. I was pretty depressed. But we got to the end. We officially stopped at the place where Eliza achieved her freedom for the second time there in downtown Chicago. And then we went to a little ceremony that the Frederick Douglass Family Initiative put on. And once I was walking to the church where the ceremony was going to be held, my little daughter saw me. She was outside, and she like saw me, and she started running to me. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is a Kodak moment. I wish I could tape this, but it was just one of those moments that's going to stick in my head. And I was like, okay, I'm happy that the walk's over. My two-year-old daughter ran into my arms, and I could finally say I was done. Celia and Eliza, although their stories may seem small to people, they're part of the reason why we have so much freedom today. I think that's what some people forget, is they think Abraham Lincoln is the reason why we have so many freedoms, or people in politics are the reason why we have so many freedoms. But it's really the little people that suffered hardships and went through so much, to me, are more important. And it's also a story of a multiracial network of men and women that helped them escape and achieve their freedom. The big thing that I really try to push today is we have to replicate history, where it's going to take a multiracial network of men and women to stop modern day slavery.
In the morning, you shall be free.
I done told you,
you shall be free.
I said it,
you shall be free.
What did you use that $100 bill that Tom gave you for?
I still have not used it. It's in my wallet in a special compartment, just like Tom had it. And I'm waiting for a time where I'm going to use it to directly help someone else. But I want to make sure that I use it for something that, if I knew Tom's mom, I want to make her happy. You know, she's proud of what Tom did, and I want to make it worth something. I want to make her proud of where that money has gone as well. So I wanted to give it to the Frederick Douglass Initiative, but they said, nope, that's for you to figure out, and you need to do something else with it. So I'm waiting to figure out what else I can do with that.
Our storyteller was Barry Jurgensen. He and his three students, and another teacher who helped organize the walk, were awarded the Frederick Douglass Human Rights Award from the Frederick Douglass Family Initiatives. You can find out more about that organization at their website, fdfi.org. Barry says he's planning another walk to bring awareness to human trafficking. Caroline Ballard. You can hear more stories where humans and our habitat meet at our website, humannaturepodcast.org. You can also subscribe to the show so you never miss an episode. Look for us on Apple Podcasts and Google Play Music. Just search for Human Nature with one N. You can also connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Anna Rader is our digital producer, Aaron Jones produces the show, and our senior producer is Micah Schweitzer. Human Nature is a production of Wyoming Public Media. It's Human Nature.